This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Good evening and welcome to The Informer. Dean Beck with you this evening. Australia's HIV response is one of the best in the world, but we still have some things to do when it comes to getting everyone who needs to be tested. Tonight we'll be joined by Associate Professor Mark Stouve from the Burnet Institute, who has a few things to say regarding HIV testing. We'll also explore homelessness and the issue of rough sleeping for the LGBTI community. And we'd love to hear from you. You can SMS 0427JOY949 or email on air at joy.org.au. And I also have a poll going on Twitter, and it asks the question, if HIV home tests were available, would you use them? You can respond to that poll on Twitter. Just go to at Dean Beck on air and answer yes or no to the question, would you use an HIV home test, yes or no? Without doubt, one of the biggest issues socially, both here in Victoria and indeed right around our nation, is the issue of homelessness. Recently, women and children in crisis received a bit of a boost with some 20 new dwellings being funded and 27 rental properties, and that's come out of the Victorian government's coffers, a result of a Royal Commission. But what about LGBTI people? What about our community and their housing needs? Well, one man who's there at the forefront is Tony Keenan. He's the CEO of Launch Housing. He joins us on The Informer. Tony, welcome.
Thanks, Dean. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Tony, what is the state of play with housing for the most needy within the LGBTI communities?
Well, we certainly see at our services, we see an overrepresentation of trans people, particularly trans women, at our crisis accommodation services. We're not sure whether that particularly because they presented our services, but we suspect it's much more to do with discrimination and the poor treatment that trans women and trans men experience with, in their experience of being homeless. Often, when people are homeless, they end up in dodgy rooming houses, and their experience of violence and abuse and being stood over is really harsh, and often they can present to regular services which won't be necessarily that trans-friendly. As well, we know that certainly with young gay and lesbian people, our services would suggest there's an overrepresentation there. The reality is we don't have hard data yet, so we'd like to get that hard data to establish, you know, irrefutably the difference or the fact that people from our community are overrepresented in homelessness.
So that data forms, like I guess the census that we sort of had last night, that data forms pathways for government to fund housing, does it?
Yeah, look, to housing and services, absolutely, absolutely. So what we're dealing with in Victoria and Australia is an absolute crisis in affordable housing and social housing. So in the time I started, I've been in this work for 10 years now. When I started Victoria, roughly 6% of the housing stock in Victoria was social housing. It's now nearly 3%. And that's less than we see in the US. So we've got to do something to get our social housing stocks back up. The Department of Human Services does a rental report. The last rent report for the last quarter showed that there are only 29 one-bedroom properties across the entire Melbourne area that were deemed affordable in the private rental market.
Wow.
So there's an absolute crisis. And if you've got other issues that you're dealing with, if you've got family violence, family rejection, and particularly if you've lost connections and contacts, you get to be homeless pretty quickly.
And it's a culmination of a lot of things, isn't it? It's you know, their health outcomes as well. It's connections and networks and communities. It's families and individuals. And it's an all of, I guess, society response that is required, is it not?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, people talk about the three basic requirements for food, clothing, shelter. So it's pretty, we can pretty much get food, we can pretty much get clothing in Melbourne, we can't get shelter. And, you know, So without that, you can't do the other stuff. We know there's reams and reams of evidence that shows lack of housing or homelessness or substandard housing leads to incredibly bad health outcomes. We know that a lot of people become sick because they're homeless. A lot of people know about the relationship between drug and alcohol abuse and mental illness and homelessness. But people usually think that's what caused the homelessness, and we've got evidence now that shows that, you know, people with mental illness and drug and alcohol problems who are homeless develop those issues as a result of being homeless, not the other way around. Mm-hmm.
What's the quick fix? Is it a simple case of saying to developers, every 100 apartments you build, 10 of them have to be cheap accommodation for this sector? How do we fix this?
I won't pussyfoot around, yes.
Right.
Most other countries have done that. It's called inclusionary zoning.
Yeah.
The US, and we talk to private developers now, they just say, do it. They've got business models. They've been expecting it for years.
Is that a legislative issue, or what's
it? Yeah, it's a legislative planning issue.
Right.
But what you have is a school of thought, the free market ideologues, that say that if you do that, it'll interfere with the market. Yes, well, it will. But any intervention by government interferes with the market. And they'll say it distorts the market. Well, yes, it will, but not nearly as much as negative gearing distorts the market. So you need to distort the market. We have a market failure. People in poverty and people on low incomes can't afford market rent. So we need to do something. So the government needs to intervene either through paying subsidies, building more houses, or doing other mechanisms such as inclusionary zoning, which will get extra housing.
But surely developers would just factor that into the selling price of their other units, wouldn't they?
Absolutely. Every single developer I've discussed this with, we work closely with developers. Every single developer said, for God's sake, just make a decision. So give us some certainty and so we can get on with it.
So it's political will that's holding it back?
I think you've got some ideologues in Treasury in the department that continue to advise against it. I think there's certainly will from the current government, certainly the current Minister for Planning, Richard Wynn, who's a friend of the community and had housing and homelessness prior to having planning. I think he's very keen to see this brought about, and I think we should all work with him to make sure it happens.
So it's a state-based issue, and yet we keep hearing from our federal politicians that we'll fix homelessness, or whatever that thing that Mr Rudd said years ago. What incentive can federal government give in this space?
Well, it's both. Housing and homelessness has always been a joint Commonwealth and state responsibility.
So is health, and look at that nightmare.
Yes, I know. But, I mean, one big thing that's the problem is that the Commonwealth Rent Assistance, which is the additional subsidy for people on very low incomes to try and assist them into the private market, is so low and it's never been indexed.
Mm.
So the most you can get is $65 a week on that. So Commonwealth Rent Assistance is something that could be looked at. So, another thing that the Commonwealth could look at, they do spend a lot on negative gearing. And I think negative gearing is politically difficult. So what we'd say, if you're not going to change negative gearing, at least get better value out of it. So, you know, federal governments could require people with negatively geared properties to rent them at a reduced rent. So there are a range of things that could be done. The problem is so vast that we think that no government could find the level of funding to inject to solve the problem straight away. But so there needs to be a whole range of things. We need to see what governments can do. We need to see what community can do working with the private sector. But there needs to be a concerted response and a concerted effort.
Do you have any anecdotal evidence of HIV having an impact in this space? Are people contracting HIV who then, due to trying to deal with that, their job falls away and then they become homeless?
Certainly we have clients who are HIV positive, and certainly we have some clients who have multiple issues, and HIV will be one of them. And so, yes, we see that. Our Street to Home, which works doing assertive outreach with people who are rough sleeping, and they work to identify the 100 most vulnerable people on the streets and work with them every year to get them into housing. And it sounds pretty rough, but the intake tool they use to work out the 100 most vulnerable is a health tool. And one of the questions is around HIV, and my memory is that 5% of that cohort had HIV. So yes, HIV is an issue. And I guess, I was president of the AIDS Council in the early 90s, and at that time we still had public housing. We were able to get dedicated public housing for for people with HIV.
We also had disability payments for HIV, which don't exist anymore too.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, so that whole, I mean, we've had HIV change and we've had housing and homelessness change as well.
Tony Kennan, the rough sleeping issue is one that has just exploded on the streets of Melbourne in the last 2 years. What's going on in that space? Because I guess from a tourism perspective, it can't look pretty.
We're trying to still work out what's driven it, but the City of Melbourne and organisations like ours work to do a street count every 2 years with the CBD, or the City of Melbourne rather, and the last one was in 2014. The one that we've done this year showed a 74% increase in people rough sleeping in the City of Melbourne.
That's huge.
And it is, and it's, but people notice, everyone you talk to says what's happening. It's just so in your face and it's just so out there. What's driving it? I suspect at the end of the day it's trickle up from the lack of available affordable housing is one big thing. We suspect that people don't necessarily become homeless and living around the city, but they drift in towards the city because there's a perception of services, and that's part of it. But I think what's driving it ultimately is the lack of affordable available housing. And I guess particularly the marginal options that used to exist, like caravans, caravan parks, rooming houses, we're seeing all of those disappear as land becomes so expensive and so attractive to developers.
On The Informer, we're speaking with the CEO of Launch Housing, Tony Kennan. Tony, there's been some funding that is going to be targeted specifically at LGBTI homelessness. This is a partnership arrangement with Galfa and Melbourne University, yourself and others, I believe. Tell me how this is going to work and what the outcomes are.
Well, so this is particularly looking at trying to get better service response for trans and gender diverse people in homelessness services. And so we'll be the service partner, and the other Melbourne Uni, Transgender Victoria, etc., they will work to develop, if you like, best practice. And so we have a lot of trans clients in our services, and particularly our crisis service at South Bank. So we'll work with the researchers to develop, if you like, best practice and say this is what a transgender diverse friendly service should look like. This is how the services should operate, and with an aim of rolling that out to other services.
What would you like to tell the broader community regarding this issue at present? Or another way of putting that is, how can we help?
Look, you can help in a range of ways. There's lots and lots of services that need donations and volunteers, the obvious usual way, but particularly politicians. And talk to your politicians, talk to your local members, talk to your councillors and talk to your friends. I mean, one of the things we struggle with is that there's a lot of prejudice and there's a lot of incorrect information or perceptions about who is actually homeless and what they look like. We do perception studies, and most Australians think that if you're homeless, you're a middle-aged bloke with a drinking problem. So the biggest group of homelessness now exists in young people. For us, 68% of our clients are women and a third of our clients are children. So it's a very, very different profile than it used to be. So the other thing people can do is get themselves informed. I mean, our website's got a lot of information. That's at launchhousing.org.au. And there's also, if you have a look at that, there's other ways people can get involved.
And if we know someone who finds himself in a crisis situation, what's the first thing that we can do for them? I've personally had that situation happen recently too.
Look, things are so dire. If you're able to help practically yourself, and if you're able or in a position to provide accommodation, I'd say do that, because the services are so stretched, and that if people can help in that really practical way, that would be good. Otherwise, there is a 1-800 number that people can phone, and staff 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I can give that out.
Yes, please.
1-800-825-955. And if someone's experiencing domestic violence, the Women's Domestic Violence Crisis Service is also 24 hours, 7 days a week, and it's toll-free, 1-800-015-188. They will put you, depending on the time of the day, if it's in the day, if it's business hours, you'll come through to your local, what we call entry point. If it's after hours, there's a statewide coordinating service there.
Tony Kennan, CEO of Launch Housing, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Pleasure, Dane. Thanks for your interest.
And those numbers will be on the podcast of this episode of The Informer a little after the program. Over the last decade, some 90% of all new infections of HIV in this country have been associated with gay and bisexual men. So to find these men who are some up to 10% of which have not been yet diagnosed, we need all sorts of testing regimes. And this country last year approved rapid testing and legislated for the approval of home testing. Very little has been done in that space since. And we're joined by the head of HIV research and principal for sexual health and reproductive research at the Burnett Institute, Dr. Mark Stouvet. Thank you very much for making yourself available.
No worries. Thanks, Steve.
Why have we not seen rapid testing available, home testing available here? We can order it online and import it if we want.
Yep. Look, up till very recently, there's been some legislative restrictions on the manufacture and distribution of self-tests in Australia. But a year or more, or maybe even 2 years ago now, the health minister at the time, Minister Dutton, removed that restriction in Australia. What we need now is to get some movement on the types of self-tests that we may want to introduce into Australia that are likely to comply with the Therapeutic Goods Administration indications in terms of what performance they would accept for such tests.
The United States has had home testing available since 2012. It's available in the UK and throughout Europe and also in Kenya. Why are we so different to any other country?
Yep. Look, it takes a manufacturer to present its case to Australia for the licensing of a particular test. So we're waiting for that to occur. Also in relation to the United States, they did approve the OraSure oral fluid self-testing kit. Under the current circumstances, in terms of the performance characteristics of that test that the manufacturer actually presented to the FDA in America, that would not currently meet TGA standards.
It's not good enough.
It's not good enough. It has 91% sensitivity to HIV infection, which means about 1 in 10 people with established HIV would be missed with this test. So, in other words, they would receive a false negative result.
Now, we believe that there's 3,000 to 4,000 people that are living with HIV that are undiagnosed, mm-hmm. Which means that they have seroconverted and got through that potential illness. Only half of people who seroconvert get really sick. Yep. And so they're living amongst us unknowingly and not getting tested.
Yeah, absolutely. So, look, what we've seen over the last decade or so is quite a substantial increase in the number of tests that HIV tests that are occurring in the community at general practice and at other sites. What we haven't seen a lot of change in, however, is the frequency with which gay men test.
In fact, if we have seen a change, it's gone backwards, has it not?
No, our data suggests that it's incrementally increased. So in 2007, we estimated that about 45% of gay men had a test annually. That's increased in 2013-14 to about 53%. And those
annually?
Annually.
But you and I both know that this should be every 3 months.
Yes. For
most of us.
For high-risk men, that is the lowest common denominator, anybody who has had unprotected sex recently should be tested at every 3 months.
And, or more than a couple of partners.
Yes. Yeah. And our data suggests that as few as 15% of men who meet that criteria of high risk are testing at those frequencies. So what we really need to do is make testing as easy as bloody possible for people to do. And that does not involve fixed site testing at services that require an appointment and sometimes require you to come back for a test result. I think it's time that we put the responsibility for testing in the hands of the individuals who would like to test and make that as simple as possible and to do that at home.
Last year, the Medical Journal of Australia reported that there are about 10,000 gay and bisexual men who've never had a test ever.
Yep. And that's a real concern. Look, I'm not sure that a self-test would potentially be suitable for someone who's never tested before. I think there are a whole range of issues and a whole range of pieces of information that can be provided for someone during the pre and post-test counselling process. But I would suggest that men who are used to attending their GP or sexual health centre or Pronto and, you know, are routinely engaged in testing, to help them do that more frequently and according to guidelines would be a very useful exercise. And if we can get those high-risk men just ordering a test, for example, online that gets sent to their house and we provide them with appropriate support services, you know, through online mechanisms or otherwise to support them if they had a positive test, that would really go a long way in expanding the reach of testing and also expanding the potential for testing in a prevention context.
But why shouldn't I be able to go to my local chemist and for $25 buy a 3-pack of whatever the test is?
Yep. At the moment, it's having a test that is TGA approved. If we had a test that's TGA approved, there would be nothing stopping those tests entering the market, either being provided through an online service or over the counter.
And yet over the counter you can find out whether you're pregnant or not, just not whether you got HIV.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of very interesting parallels to the hysteria that occurred in the 1960s when pregnancy tests were taken out of the control of the clinical workforce.
Initially available only on prescription, I wonder? They were.
I believe so.
Wow.
And
because that'll be next.
Yes, and there was a certain hysteria at the time of, God forbid, putting women's sexual health in control, you know, in their control. And I would argue that that's exactly what we need to do with gay men, is put their, you know, this aspect at least of their sexual health in their hands and within their control.
A very recent study in the United States reported by CNN, which used Grindr to market specifically to this cohort of, in this case, they were black American men and Latino men. They offered free access to these home test kits through banner ads and full screen notifications on Grindr, and you could choose how you wanted it received, either by mail, by redeeming it a voucher at a local pharmacy, or you could go to a vending machine, put in a code, and it would pop out for you. And they invited people to then participate in a research study, but you didn't really have to even do that. And from that, they got some very interesting responses. We've had only a couple of opportunities to research in this area, and you want to do more?
Yes, absolutely. So there's the fourth trial that's currently being run out of the University of New South Wales that is using the oral fluid specimen collection device and test. And that's, you know, those results are pending in relation to that trial, the primary outcome being, has it increased the frequency with which people will test? I would argue that what we need to do in Australia is actually trial a home-based finger prick test, because in terms of the performance of those tests, that is probably the only type of self-test that is likely to be approved by the TGA. As I said before, the performance characteristics of the oral fluid test at the moment do not meet the publicly stated threshold for performance by the TGA.
If we remove the antigen window from the current rapid HIV rapid test that are being used here locally, why couldn't we use that at home? It's very accurate.
Look, the technology is very standard. So really, it's what we call a lateral flow test, where the, you know, the blood travels up a sort of piece of card, a tube, and, yeah, and you put buffer on that. The actual strips themselves are fairly generic.
And cheap.
And absolutely very cheap. And I'm aware of manufacturers who are optimising their finger prick tests for self-testing as we speak that are almost, I would argue, foolproof once they, you know, get to the point of manufacture and are very, very simple to use. That the manufacturer, I've been told, is would anticipate to go to market at about $25 a pop.
Per test?
Per test.
Available over the counter?
Potentially, yeah, over the counter if it was TGA approved, and also, you know, could be available online through an innovative sort of online system. And look, if you know, that would ultimately equate for a gay man who wants to test, who would like to test four times a year, $100 a year for that, you know, security in sort of knowing that, you know, they've had a recent test.
Cost you more than that to go to a private GP.
Exactly. By the time you factor into the gap fee at a GP, the time it takes, you know, GPs are open 9 to 5, and the time away from work, I think $25 a test at home is not a bad option.
My issue with you doing more research is that it will delay the inevitable, and what we really need is this now. So how do we make this happen and fast-track it?
Look, for me, getting some research trials up is simply a way of advocating for, you know, what you and I think are the obvious.
How much do you need?
Look, I think we could design quite a good trial. In fact, I have one
ready to go.
I have one that's currently being considered by the National Health and Medical Research Council. A 2-year trial that, you know, I think, you know, you could probably get done for, you know, $500,000 or even less if we really, you know, stretch things. And
but that then says to me it's going to be at least 2.5, maybe 3 years before I can buy one over the counter if I needed one.
Look, ultimately, there would be nothing during that trial, there would be nothing stopping a manufacturer from presenting their case to the TGA. Unfortunately, sometimes the TGA can indeed take 12, 18, 24 months to actually assess a device. And that was the circumstance in which the Determined device was approved, and ultimately the Unigold device, which was approved as well, which is the device Pronto currently uses.
It took about a decade for us to get rapid testing available here. Home testing is making inroads and delivering outcomes for the positive health outcomes for individuals throughout the world. It is incomprehensible that we don't have home testing available here.
Yep. And I actually think even though it is available in other countries, there are certain aspects of their system that I would describe as less than efficient. I think there actually is an opportunity for Australia to lead the world in this, in developing a best practice approach to home testing.
I recall hearing a radio GP on a black American radio station advocating for people to have in the top drawer beside their bed a whole bunch of home HIV tests, and each time you took home trade before you got into the doing the do, you said suck on this. I don't think that's what we're talking about in this space, but I do hope that people will have the right to test of their own accord and in their own privacy, and hopefully we'll see more people getting the results that they need.
No problem. Could I just chuck in one little
plug
for a study that we're doing at the Burnet at the moment? We've got an online survey running at the moment that serves two purposes. It's designed to help evaluate the current social marketing strategies in Victoria for HIV and STI prevention, but we're also asking men questions around their current knowledge, beliefs, attitudes and behaviours around new HIV prevention strategies.
How do we do it?
You can go to the Burnet website, and there's a link on the main page. If people are interested in participating, we would really love to have our approach in Victoria informed by the community.
And the study is called?
It's just a HIV prevention evaluation survey. But as I said, has a significant component, particularly around people's attitudes and behaviours around PrEP.
We'll put a link to that study on the podcast page of this particular program. Mark Stivay, Associate Professor and Head of HIV Research at Burnet, thank you for joining us on The Informer.
Thanks again, Dean.
And that is it for me for tonight. You can follow me on Twitter at Dean Beck on Air, and do check out the podcasts of The Informer available at joy.org.au/The Informer. Till next time, keep well, take care. Bye for now.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.